Okay. I want to thank everyone for joining once again. This is the History of Zionism, Part 10. It's the series finale entitled Destruction and Rebirth. I want to thank again Becky and Avi Katz for sponsoring this year's series, Le'ila Nishmat Rav Yonah ben Rav Aryeh Leib, and I most appreciate it. The truth is that this final installment in the series is most appropriate for Tisha B'Av, especially the title Destruction and Rebirth, because on Tisha B'Av we relive the Churban and we begin to sense in the afternoon some of the Nechama as well. And that really is the story we're telling this afternoon. There's no decade in many centuries that has been as fateful for the Jewish people as was the 1940s. The first decade of the 58th century since the creation of man. The two defining events of the 20th century for Jews occurred in the same decade, just a few years apart, the Holocaust and the reestablishment of the State of Israel. The latter was a realization, the realization of the Zionist vision. The former was its worst nightmare, and for many years, its motivating force, such that after the Holocaust, there were even voices that said, why do we need an Israel now? The whole purpose of a State of Israel was to save European Jewry, and unfortunately that's gone. Nonetheless, they overcame that pretty quickly. But the response of the Zionist movement to the Holocaust was equivocal, controversial, and ultimately disappointing. What it did was galvanize the movement in its aftermath to focus on statehood and now, without accepting further procrastination on the part of the British, with even the moderate establishment diverging into the illegal activities it had long shunned. But as we know, the price paid was enormous. The success was a revolution in Jewish life and a transformation of Jewish history. And the stage will be set for years of building, conflict, war, development, prosperity, kibbutz Goliot, and the realization of the ancient dreams and hopes and prophecies of the Jewish people. The Holocaust would shape the Jewish state for decades and to some extent until today. We've already discussed the trepidations of Zev Jabotinsky and his shrill, vociferous warnings to the Jewish people in the 1930s. But Chaim Weizmann also warned, for example, the Jews of Munich in 1932, flee, because Hitler means every word. He had read Mein Kampf. In 1938, he told a friend, I'm distressed that the Jews don't understand the apocalyptic nature of the times. Part of us will be destroyed, and on their bones may new Judea arise. It is all terrible, but it is so. So how did the Zionist movement respond to the storm clouds in Europe, and how do they push forward towards statehood exactly 50 years after Herzl wrote that it would happen in 50 years? In May 1939, the British issued another white paper that severely restricted Jewish immigration to Israel, and again in response to Arab threats of violence. So those who argue, hear it all the time, that Arabs had no role in the Holocaust, and so they've suffered for European sins, the people who claim that are duplicitous propagandists. But for the white paper, the land of Israel would have been an obvious refuge for Jews. And the white paper came about only because of the Arabs. So it's true that the Arabs were mostly uninvolved in killing Jews, mostly, not entirely, but they had a primary role in ensuring that there was no escape for fleeing Jews. The Mufti, Haj Amin al-Husseini, spent the war years in Berlin. There was a Muslim force in Albania that persecuted Jews, but more typical of his efforts, the Mufti, for example, on May 6, 1942, protested that the Bulgarian government, the King of Bulgaria, was very supportive of Jews, and the country was largely protective of Jews and had one of the lowest rates of persecution and extermination of Jews, they were allowing Jews to emigrate to Israel. Please mute. Please mute. The Bulgarians were allowing Jews to emigrate to flee the Nazis instead of sending them to Poland under strong and energetic guard to be killed, as the Mufti insisted the Bulgarians do. The white paper committed to another 75,000 Jewish immigrants over 5 years, a quota that was not met, and after that, nothing more. A state would arise in 10 years under the white paper, but a binational state with a permanent Arab majority and a Jewish minority. Perhaps worse, it stated explicitly that since there were now 450,000 Jews living in Israel, the British obligations under the Balfour Declaration for a state, a national home for the Jewish people, had been met, and a Jewish state would erode, if not eradicate, Britain's commitment to preserve the civil rights of the Arabs. And this was the text. His Majesty's government believe that the framers of the mandate in which the Balfour Declaration was embodied could not have intended that Palestine be converted into a Jewish state against the will of the Arab population of the country. His Majesty's government therefore now declare unequivocally that it is not part of their policy that Palestine should become a Jewish state. They would indeed regard it as contrary to their obligations to the Arabs under the mandate, as well as to the assurances which have been given to the Arab people in the past that the Arab population of Palestine should be made the subjects of a Jewish state against their will. Well, the Balfour Declaration had been sort of vague, saying nothing that constitutes a Jewish home should prejudice the civil rights of the Arabs, but it was never this clear and explicit and really anti the notion of a Jewish homeland or state. And the British were quite open about their motivations. Quote, "If we must defend one side, let us defend the Jews rather than the Arabs. And if war broke out, the British knew it could count on Jewish support and so tried to court Arab support." And that's a pattern. The Arabs, for example, Arabs here paid no political price for supporting Saddam Hussein during the first Gulf War or during the war with Iraq in the early 2000s. They're never held responsible for their bad choices. Or for example, when Jews build illegally or on questionable land, the legal establishment leaps into action in order to destroy what has been built. When Arabs build illegally, a blind eye is turned. And it's the same thing in America, you know. Jews are attacked, so you have, at the most, mild objections. If someone in another ethnic group is attacked, the whole country comes to a halt. Well, the squeaky wheel does get the grease. And the white paper explicitly repudiated a promise to the British made to the Zionists just 6 months earlier, that they're moving the direction of a homeland. Even Weizmann saw this as what he called a death sentence for European Jews. Nonetheless, he still perceived the British as operating in good faith. An elderly David Lloyd George denounced the white paper as a betrayal, as an act of perfidy. Winston Churchill voted against it, despite the fact that it was his own party, led by the perfidious Prime Minister Chamberlain, that promulgated it. And of course, Jews in Israel were horrified. Illegal immigration soared, such that the British, in July 1939, 6 weeks before the outbreak of the war, banned all Jewish immigration, legal or otherwise. There were attacks on British installations. Jabotinsky from exile secretly proposed an invasion that would depose the British, drive them from the land, and a declaration of statehood, mindful that the cost in Jewish life in this revolution would be huge. He himself would lead the invasion, he said. And Irgun leader Avram Stern proposed recruiting 40,000 Jews from Europe to participate. Alas, while the planning for this was going on, World War II broke out, but not before another dastardly, treacherous event took place. In August 1939, the 21st Zionist Congress met in Geneva to denounce the white paper and to plan future strategy. True to form, Chaim Weizmann remained unrepentantly pro-British, and he declared that the Zionists would support Britain if war broke out. He said, "We have our grievances against England, as the political resolutions show, but England's troubles are our troubles. Her battle is our battle." It was during this conference that the Ribbentrop-Molotov Pact was signed and announced, an alliance between Germany and the Soviet Union that sealed the fate of Poland. There's a famous picture of the reaction when news hit the conference. A worried Moshe Sharet sitting next to a glum Ben-Gurion with his hands crossed and his head staring down, sitting next to a morose Chaim Weizmann, who had rejoined the leadership after a hiatus of a few years, with his head resting on his hand, eyes closed, looking forlorn. And all Weizmann could say at the end, and this is already starting the fourth week of August in 1939, a week before the war broke out, all Weizmann could say was, "I hope we see each other alive at the next Congress." He concluded, "Lehitraot shalom." The next Congress would take place in Basel in 1946, after the Holocaust. World War II started just a few days after the Geneva Conference ended. Almost 30% of the Zionist executive, the European Jews, 20 out of 72 people, died during the Holocaust. By the time the next Congress did take place, the one in 1946 in Basel, 40% of the representatives would be from the United States. So you see the great shift. Europe was destroyed with its Jews, and now the locus of Jewish life shifted to America. When the Nazis invaded Poland on September 1st, and Britain and France declared war to protect Poland, Ben-Gurion declared famous words, "We will fight the war as if there were no white paper, and we will fight the white paper as if there were no war." It's a great slogan, but neither was true, as the Zionists had their own motivations and interests during the war, and saving the life of every Jew was not at the top of the list. By the same token, they did not fight the white paper either in any meaningful way. So for sure they saw the Nazis as the greatest threat to European Jewry, and so aiding the British to defeat the Nazis was the primary concern. But could they have made a difference with a different policy? Of course, we'll never know. Emigration was an option that had long ago exhausted itself. In 1939, there were 18 million Jews in the world, exceptional growth from the 2 million in 1800. America had the largest population, slightly under 5 million, almost the same as today, if not slightly more than now, if you count only Jews according to halacha. But the gates of America were closed, and that 18 million figure, think about it, we don't come close to reaching that today, 75 years after the Holocaust. FDR adamantly opposed Jewish immigration, with a jaunty smile, of course, and let others make the cruel decisions and announcements. But in truth, he was in line with the majority sentiment of the country. And for all we like to blame FDR, and I'll be happy to do that as well, polls showed that from the late 1930s on, almost 80% of Americans opposed relaxing the quotas to admit more Jews. And Jew hatred was rampant in America, and most Jews were too fearful to demand a change. Instead, the establishment curried favor with FDR, hoping something would come of it, and nothing did. Notwithstanding the overwhelming Jewish support for Roosevelt election after election. With the existence of a Jewish state in the 1930s precluded the Holocaust. So Lucy Davidovits, the historian for one, insists that it could have. Jews had no political power across the world. There was no country that was devoted even a small share of its resources to protecting Jews. So a Jewish state, in theory, could have been more forceful in pleading for Jewish immigration from the endangered countries. But the conceptual error lies in thinking that history evolves in a linear fashion. If there's A, then there's B, then there's C. Such that if A could have been thwarted, B and C could not have happened. But that's foolish and incorrect. A Jewish state would have had to have been well armed to matter militarily, and Hitler might have then made the Jewish state his first target. As it is, it's not well known, but 137 Jews in Tel Aviv were killed on September 9, 1940, when the Italians bombed Tel Aviv, exclusively hitting residential areas. It was actually the greatest attack on Jews in the land of Israel, and one of the few ones during World War II. And the turning point of the war occurred when the Nazis were repulsed in 1942 in the battles of El Alamein, a town on the Mediterranean coast about 60 miles west of Alexandria, Egypt. These were two ferocious battles that were fought several months apart. The first real defeat the Nazis sustained in World War II, and this is what stood between the Nazis and the land of Israel, where they too had plans to round up and slaughter the Jews. Indeed, it was this battle that halted the Nazi advance through North Africa that Churchill described as, quote, "Now, this is not the end, it is not even the beginning of the end, but it is perhaps the end of the beginning." And after the war, he recognized, Churchill did, the significance of El Alamein. Before Alamein, we never had a victory. After Alamein, we never had a defeat. And it was this Allied triumph at El Alamein that preserved the Jews of Israel. But Davidovits' assertion also overlooks a more fundamental aspect of Jewish history, and that, of course, is the Ratzon Hashem, God's will. It is haughty but prevalent to think that if only I did this or that, the tragedy could not have occurred. So this contradicts the halacha you find in Shulchan Aruch and Shin Ayin Vav, quoting the Gemara in Yerideya. Va'al yomar odam la'aveil, a person should not say to a mourner, malacha lasot, ki efshar lishanot, what could you have done? It's impossible to change. And you think, no, it's natural, it's acceptance. No, shezeu kigiduf, that is actually blasphemy. Demashma, ha, im efshar lishanot hayaosa. The implication is, if I could have changed something, I would have. Eliyakabel olav gzeret Hashem et barach me'ava. We have to accept God's decrees with love. So it's trite and borderline heretical to say if we had done this or that, there would have been no Holocaust, except for this point. Had Jews left Europe when they could have, there would have been no Holocaust. But that hindsight is unfair. If you look, for example, at the crisis of American Jewry today, Jews attacked in the streets, Jews having to rally against Jew hatred, and Jews having to plead for police protection and prosecution of assailants, so you realize the difficulty in leaving Europe. All American Jews have to do today to solve the problem of Jew hatred in America is to come to Israel, and they'll be free of that scourge, period. And it's easier today than 100 years ago when there was no state of Israel. But people don't come for whatever reason, and now we understand why it's unfair to blame Europe's Jews for not leaving. It's not simple. What matters is not what we think we should have done, but what we do. And thus it was during the Battle of El Alamein that Rav Yosef Kahaneman, the Panovich Rav, broke ground in Bnei Brak for what became the rebuilt yeshiva of Panovich, with the Nazis on the doorstep of Eretz Yisrael. That is faith. Suffice it to say that the Zionists chose to put their interest in statehood, tepid as it was, on the back burner so as not to harm the British war effort. In this, the Irgun agreed, at least for a few years, but members of the Irgun led by Avram nicknamed Yair Stern, dissented and formed Lochamei Chayrut Yisrael, Lehi, fighters for the freedom of Israel, and they would pursue acts of violence and aggressive actions bent on rescue of Jews and sovereignty over the land of Israel, even during World War II. And that was the reason for the split. And when Stern dissented and left in June 1940, that division was premised on 3 points on which Yair Stern disagreed with Zev Jabotinsky. One, that Jews should fight against the British government in Israel and not join the British army and collaborate with anyone who fought against the British and could advance their objectives. Oddly, and in retrospect, foolishly and repugnantly, that included outreach to the Nazis. So it was almost the reverse of the others, whereas the others felt that the main enemy were the Nazis, and they have to support the British against the Nazis. Stern felt the main enemy was the British, because he wanted the British out of Israel. So if they would help the Nazis, they would be hurting the British. In 1941, again, you have to, this is 1940, so you can't say that they knew the Holocaust would unfold, but nonetheless, in retrospect, it's striking. In 1941, for example, a Lehi representative met in Beirut with an official from the German Foreign Ministry and offered to solve the Nazis' so-called Jewish problem by taking all the Jews from Europe, bringing them to Israel. And the purpose was to conquer the land of Israel from the British, thereby weakening the British and indirectly satisfying two Nazi interests. But the Germans were not interested, and by the time word of the final solution reached Israel, talks had ended, and soon after, on February 12, 1942, after Lehi attacks on the British, Avram Stern was captured in Tel Aviv, in hiding, handcuffed, and then shot to death by the British. So what did the Zionist establishment do during the Holocaust? This is a controversial area until today. The support for the British became harder to justify in December 1941 when a boat, the Struma, left Romania with 769 Jewish refugees. It was a dilapidated cattle ship, one bathroom for all the passengers. They landed in Turkey, they sought visas in Israel, and they were rejected by the British. After 2 months, the Turks ferried the Struma out to sea, left it there, and it soon sank, apparently blown up by a Soviet torpedo, drowning all aboard except for one survivor. And this disaster occurred a little over a year after the Patria catastrophe, another refugee ship, 1,700 Jews in all, that was also denied entry by the British, even though it already landed in Haifa. The Haganah, to avoid deportation of the citizens, smuggled a bomb on board with the hope of disabling the ship and leaving the British with no choice but to bring the Jews ashore. Well, that part of the plan worked, but unfortunately, the bomb was too powerful and quickly sank the ship. More than 200 Jewish refugees perished right off the coast of the land of Israel. So what do they do? The first response, which Jabotinsky was working on when he died in July 1940, was to form a Jewish army to fight the Nazis. Just like the Jewish Legion during World War I, it had a dual role, to fight the enemy and also to train Jews for future combat in the land of Israel. But because of that, the British were cool to the idea. Many endorsed it wholeheartedly, like Churchill, but did nothing to actually implement it. So Churchill had very good emotions and very wonderful speeches, but in terms of actions, not much. More than 130,000 Jews volunteered to fight under British command, but in the early years of the war, they were not sent to Europe, and so could not save Jews. Where were they sent? Well, as an example, the first commander of the Irgun, David Raziel, a chavrut of Rav Tzvi Yehuda Cook, when they learned in Merkaz together, he was killed in Iraq while fighting under British command, his vehicle strafed by a Luftwaffe fighter. This was in May 1941. The Irgun would then stagnate under the leadership of Yaakov Meridor until Menachem Begin, freed from a Soviet prison camp and released from the Polish army, the Anders army, in which he enlisted, he became head of the Irgun in December 1942, choosing to stay in Israel and fight for a Jewish state than go with the British to Europe. But less than 3 weeks after Raziel was killed, Moshe Dayan, also fighting under British command in Lebanon, lost his eye when his binoculars absorbed a bullet fired by Vichy French forces. So there was a Jewish army, but the British kept them all in the Middle East, away from Europe. It would be a stretch to say that these fighting Jews play any significant role. In one of the famous and heroic accounts taught a generation of Jewish youth my age, I remember when I heard this story first, Chana Senesh was part of a small special forces unit that parachuted into Yugoslavia in March of 1944 with a plan of infiltrating Hungary and attempting the rescue of Hungarian Jews. She was captured the moment she crossed the border into Hungary, so her deeds had zero operational effect. But she was a heroine, relentlessly tortured by the Nazis to get her to reveal information about her comrades. She refused, and after more than 6 months of captivity, she was executed by firing squad November 7th, 1944. It was between March and November when she entered Hungary, was caught, and when she was executed, that more than 560,000 Hungarian Jews were murdered, Hashem Yikom Damam, mostly in Auschwitz. That was the last large group of Jews to be murdered. Chana Senesh is also remembered for her poetry as well, set to music, Keli, Keli, Shalo Yigamer Le'olam, etc. So what do they do? And this becomes the crucial and infuriating answer. What do the Zionists do? Not much. I mean, to be fair, what could they have done? But to be honest, whatever they might have done, pressure, protests, attacks on the British to open up Israel to Jewish refugees, smuggling Jewish agents into Europe to rescue Jews, acquire publicized intelligence about the Nazi plans and atrocities, whatever they might have done, they did not do because of infighting, because of divisions in the movement. Chaim Weizmann was based in London and could see no evil in the British. Ben-Gurion was based in Israel and wavered between supporting the British, promoting immigration, legal or otherwise, or forcefully advocating for statehood. Those were the years he could never decide. In frustration, Ben-Gurion during the war twice resigned his position, only to return. Each man, Weizmann, Gurion, sniped at the other. And add to that the constant British pressure on the Jews, disarming them, sending activists to exile in Eritrea, later Cyprus, and the Zionists were not as much indifferent as divided and helpless. Perhaps they were helpless because they were so divided. And this echoed the strife between Jews in the Warsaw Ghetto, in which the socialists and Bundes factions refused to cooperate with the Beitar faction, refused to even talk to them. It was during the war, after the catastrophe was already unfolding, that it dawned on the leadership that Jewish independence and statehood was the only answer. And both Weizmann and Gurion spent significant time in the U.S. during the war, with Ben-Gurion realizing the important role, the critical role, the U.S. would play after the Nazis were defeated. A quote from Walter Laqueur's History of Zionism. There was no progress at all during 1942 and 1943. By then, more than half the Holocaust had already taken place. Nothing happened. They did nothing. They did nothing meaningful. Again, quoting, in August 1944, Weizmann was told by Churchill that the War Office would soon be in a position to discuss concrete proposals. By then, more than 80 to 90% of the 6 million had already been murdered. So what were they doing? Weizmann was enamored with Churchill, who always said the right thing. After the war, we'll carry through with the Balfour Declaration. But after the war, Churchill was gone. And they got an even worse runaround from FDR, who promised them everything but did little to nothing to save refugees or advance Zionist interests, notwithstanding that the Jews fawned over him. Neither man, neither Roosevelt nor Churchill, had the slightest inclination to bomb Auschwitz or the railways leading to it. One of the requests that was actually made by the Zionists, among others. And one of the one time when they asked for it, it generated this classic response from John McCloy, who was Assistant Secretary of the Army in the U.S. Such an effort, even if practicable, might provoke more vindictive action by the Germans. More vindictive than 6 death camps? McCloy never elaborated. The Zionist response to the Holocaust was plagued by indecisiveness, timidity, fear, ambiguity, internal animosity, power struggles, and helplessness. And American Jews did not fare much better. The evil was the Nazis' evil, but the response of most Jews in free countries was pathetic, inadequate, and shameful. Yeah, there were efforts. The Vat Hatzalah, the group headed by Rav Kook's nephew, Hillel Kook, also known as Peter Bergson, that were much more aggressive, and so they attracted hostility from the establishment groups, who then told the politicians, ignore them, they're extremists. Abba Hillel Silva, the Reform rabbi and Zionist and a Republican, even had a pro-statehood resolution introduced in Congress. But without the support of FDR, who opposed it, it lost. But Silva favored a bipartisan approach, both to rescue and Zionism, as opposed to Stephen Wise's all-in with FDR. How much were Jews deluded by FDR? Well, when he died, an American Zionist publication eulogized him. He was our friend when friends were few indeed. He raised his voice when few his voice would heed, to stir the conscience of the world, to plead that ancient wrongs be righted and our people freed. He said nothing of the sort, and he did nothing of the sort. He just bamboozled everyone, and the Jews allowed themselves to be bamboozled. On the other hand, you have 2 objectionable theories that can be discounted as well. There's a certain fellow lives not far from here, not named Mahmoud Abbas, who's the head of the PA, who wrote his doctoral dissertation for a university in Moscow entitled The Other Side, The Secret Relationship Between Nazism and Zionism, calling the Zionist leaders partners with the Nazis, downplaying the Holocaust, especially its scope. He denied the possibility that 6 million Jews were murdered, citing Holocaust deniers in the process. So that is false and repugnant as well. But a similar indictment has come from extreme Haredi groups like Neturei Karta and others, who have termed the Zionists Amalek's accomplices. It's not that it's without its fragments of truth, but it's primarily meant to deflect attention from their own failings. So, for example, one of the leaders of Hungarian Jewry, later to become a bureaucrat in Israel, was Rudolf Kastner, one of the most controversial figures in the Holocaust. The scope of the accusations against him exceeds the evidence, which doesn't necessarily mean that he was innocent. Kastner discovered the Nazi plans to deport and exterminate Hungarian Jewry in April 1944. He didn't warn Hungarian Jews. He could have, but he didn't. And that's a major part of the indictment against him. Many could have escaped. He and others, Ksherim, good people, negotiated with Eichmann the exchange of Jews for money and valuables. And that did take place. The mother of Chana Senish accused him of giving away her daughter's position and doing nothing to save her from execution. And most famously, he arranged the Kastner trains that in June 1944 sent more than 1,600 Jews to safety, including his own family and, ironically, the Satmar Rebbe. There's a lot going on psychologically when you realize that for all the claims that the Sakra make against the Zionists, they have to reckon with the reality that the Zionists save the Satmar Rebbe's life. Freud couldn't resolve that. Eichmann broke the agreement and had the train diverted to Bergen-Belsen, but the passengers were rescued through a huge bribe that was paid by the Sternbuchs, famous religious Orthodox activists, Holocaust rescuers based in Switzerland. Kastner continued to negotiate with the Nazis, including a Nazi officer named Kurt Becher, whom Kastner defended at Nuremberg. Years later, in Israel, Kastner was accused of being a collaborator. He sued for libel. The trial was contentious, and the outcome was uncertain. The defendant was acquitted on most counts. On the one he lost, he was fined a pittance, like a couple of shekels. Kastner did not emerge looking vindicated. Worse for him, he was soon after assassinated on the streets of Tel Aviv by ex-Lehi activists. The Supreme Court later ruled in his favor. His case reverberates until today. His granddaughters, Merav Michaeli, now the leader of the Labor Party, who sees him as a hero. Others are less sure. Ben Hecht's book, Perfidy, made the worst-case scenario for Kastner's guilt, and that has always fueled the notion that the Zionists did not care about saving Jewish lives during the Holocaust or collaborated. Alas, it strikes me, they weren't organized enough even to collaborate if that's what they wanted to do. There was one major change in approach, even if it did not have a practical impact immediately. For 3 days, beginning on May 9th, 1942, almost 600 Jews gathered at the Biltmore Hotel in Manhattan to strategize. And they produced, Ben-Gurion and Weizmann participated, they produced what they called the Biltmore Program, which for the first time, think about it, the first time put the Zionist movement on record as demanding a state in fulfillment of the Balfour Declaration, or as was called in the document, a Jewish Commonwealth. It called for an end to the problem of Jewish homelessness, open immigration to the land of Israel, and that there be established as a Jewish commonwealth integrated in the structure of the new democratic world. It wasn't unanimous. Weizmann himself, who had always been coy about statehood, was supportive but ambivalent, as opposed to Ben-Gurion, who supported it completely. Some of the disconnect is apparent in another clause of the declaration. I quote, "This conference offers a message of hope and encouragement to their fellow Jews in the ghettos and concentration camps of Hitler-dominated Europe and prays that their hour of liberation may not be far distant." End quote. Well, thanks for that. By this time only, so to speak, only 1 to 1.5 million Jews had been murdered, and what they had to offer was thoughts and prayers. In the end, the Zionist movement saved thousands of Jews. There were famous episodes, there were real heroes. One famous case, the Tehran children, almost 1,000 in number, were refugees from Poland brought to Iran and then by the Jewish agency in Israel. Saved. But even that was not uncontroversial, because most came from religious homes, and the Jewish agency at first denied family reunification requests, and then sent them to live in secular frameworks. It's a furious argument raised by Agud in Israel, aided by the chief rabbi Herzog, and in the end, almost half found their way into some religious framework. Another worthy name, Zochel Atov, was Zerach Varhaftig, later the religious affairs minister, longtime MK in Israel, leader of the Mizrahi in Poland. So he was instrumental in convincing and then working with Chuni Sugihara, Japan's the vice consul in Kovno. Together, they saved the Mir Yeshiva in its entirety and thousands of other Jewish lives by giving them transit visas to Curacao. They stopped temporarily in Japan or Shanghai, etc. So there were successful efforts too, but they were the work more of individual Zionists and not necessarily of the Zionist movement. Could they have saved more? Well, Ben-Gurion was forever criticized for the absence of a sustained rescue effort, and probably for his support for the British during the war. And he was maligned, rightly so, for statements such as this one made after Kristallnacht. Ben-Gurion said, "Were I to know that all the German Jewish children could be rescued by transferring them to England, and only half by transfer to Palestine, I would opt for the latter, because our concern is not only the personal interest of these children, but the historic interest of the Jewish people." In other words, they did not want Jews generally. They wanted Jews who would be pioneers and fighters and farmers and mostly secular. To be fair, no group, Jewish or otherwise, Zionist or anti-Zionist, looks good after the Holocaust. The failures were rampant, the evil unimaginable. This was true of Jews in Israel and other free countries. The Zionist movement, much of the rabbinic leadership, Rav Soloveitchik was for years critical of his generation for not doing enough, and American Jews. And yeah, you had the voices, always voices, Jabotinsky and Weizmann, like I mentioned earlier, but you also had Yirmiyahu before the Churban, prophesying for 30, 40 years and being put in prison for his efforts by Jehoiakim and the people who did not want to hear it. But American Jews especially, because they were in the free country, so to speak, not subject to the subjugation of others, not in war-torn Europe. Rather than be mollified by the friendly words of the politicians, including FDR, they should have been outraged by the unfriendly, even hostile deeds of these same people. But American Jewry was weak and afraid and unassertive, and they had cast their lot with FDR and the Democrats. Stakes are different today, of course, but notice how when some of the Democrats turn on Israel, too many Jews turn on Israel rather than on the Democrats. And it was David Niles, who was an aide to FDR and then to Truman, who said, "If FDR had lived, the state of Israel would not have been established." It seems very appropriate because FDR had made such a promise even to Ibn Saud when they met shortly before FDR died, right after Yalta. After the war, it was Weizmann who advanced the claim for reparations in September 1945. Nothing came of it. He wasn't authorized to speak for Jewry, nor was there a treaty framework in which reparations could be entertained. But the notion that money would be claimed on behalf of Jews, especially since they were not the Jews that were entitled to it, it has a discordant ring to it. What did he or they do that they should be demanding money on behalf of the Jews who had been murdered or tortured? All right, the whole reparations issue in the early 50s is different, but at least then there was a Jewish state. Soon, Chaim Weizmann would be leapfrogged in the leadership of the movement, pro-British to the end, so much so that he played little substantive role in the drive for statehood, one famous meeting with Harry Truman aside. Chaim Weizmann became a figurehead in the movement, later elected Israel's first president, a ceremonial position at that, and even then he wasn't the first choice. Peace came in the spring of 1945, but for the Jews, in Lacker's phrase, it was the peace of the graveyard. The immediate aftermath of the war saw a confluence of two dire needs. There were thousands of Jewish refugees and displaced persons who had nowhere to go, and the land of Israel was the natural choice. And there was recognition that the time for independence had come, that Jews could no longer be permanent strangers in someone else's home. And there was one major obstacle, and that was the British, and one minor obstacle, the Arabs, and one new advantage. Almost all Jews were now Zionists to one extent or another, and the imperative of a Jewish state was so obvious that even the world came around to accept it grudgingly, slowly, and incompletely. On May 27th, 1945, 3 weeks after VE Day, the Jewish Agency officially petitioned the British to end their mandate and allow the establishment of a Jewish state. By the time the British responded, it was a cold rejection, Churchill was gone, and policy was being made by hostile people Clement Attlee, the Prime Minister, and especially the Foreign Secretary, Ernest Bevin, who did not believe in Jewish statehood because he did not believe Jews were a nation. What the British did was return to the program of commissions and committees until the Jewish underground forced their surrender. By 1944, the Irgun's adherence to Ben-Gurion's doctrine of supporting the British while opposing the white paper had evaporated in the smoke of the millions of exterminated Jews. On February 1, 1944, Menachem Begin declared an open revolt against the British for doing nothing for Jewish refugees, for halting immigration, and for thwarting even the establishment of a Jewish brigade. Soon after, the Irgun began attacking British government facilities, the immigration office, police headquarters in the Russian compound, aided and supplemented by the Lehi and their own attacks. The British were horrified. Begin's goal? To shatter the prestige and self-image of the British, which he thought would give them incentive to leave. When the Lehi assassinated the British Minister of State in Egypt, Lord Moyne, in November 1944, the Jewish Agency began cooperating with the British and informed and even arrested members of the two underground groups in what became known infamously as the saison, the hunting season. Hundreds of Jews were arrested by the Jewish Agency collaborators with the British and sent into exile, mainly in Eritrea in West Africa. Begin himself went into hiding, where he remained in different places and different disguises for almost 4 years until the day after independence was declared. The saison was one of the dark moments of the Zionist movement. An open civil war was only averted, just like after the Altalena, because Begin prohibited his men from fighting or informing on other Jews. But it left a long scar and began the history of troubled relations between the three fighting Jewish units. So, for example, when it became clear that the British would not relax immigration requirements in 1945, despite Jewish survivors languishing in DP camps, the Haganah joined forces with the other groups and established what was called the Jewish Resistance Front. The head of the Haganah, Moshe Sneh, was fed up, and he determined that the British had to pay a price for their obstinacy. They all worked together, all three groups, for 10 months. And these were famous actions. The railway lines were blown up, the night of the rails, the night of the bridges were blown up. They sunk British naval vessels that were enforcing the quarantine. Illegal immigration spiked. On May 1st, the Anglo-American Commission recommended maintaining the mandate. It all came to a head with the attack on the King David Hotel in July 1946. So that attack followed what was called HaShabbat HaShchora, the Black Shabbat, Black Sabbath, June 29, 1946, when the British invaded the Jewish Agency building, searched for documents that would incriminate the Jewish Agency's partners with the underground groups, and they arrested all told 2,700 groups, including some members of the Jewish Agency executive. Ben-Gurion was not arrested, he was in Paris at the time. In response to this, the King David attack was planned and took place on July 22, 1946. Note that despite the accusation of being a terrorist group, the Irgun was scrupulous in not attacking civilians and also being Shomer Shabbat. None of the actions took place on Shabbat. So the British relaxed on Shabbat. People should realize that the King David attack was not on people sitting around the swim-up bar in the pool. The King David Hotel, half the building, served as British military and administrative headquarters. And that's what was attacked. But the Irgun warning to evacuate the building was ignored, and when the half of the building was detonated, there was great loss of civilian life, 91 people in all, including some 17 Jews. The Haganah, which had known of and approved of the attack, turn tail and blame the Irgun, pretending not to know about any of it. That was a lie that had a political benefit, because Ben-Gurion feared the popularity of the underground groups, saw their effectiveness and their respect for tradition, their populist approach, the potential that they would assume power, which they eventually did long after Ben-Gurion's time. It's the same tactic he used after Deir Yassin. And again here, after the King David Hotel attack, the Jewish agency worked with the British against the Irgun, notwithstanding that so many of the Jewish agency leaders had been arrested by the British on Black Shabbat. So they got back in the good graces of the British. Later again, the three groups had worked together, and they'd again have a falling out as they came closer to statehood. Weizmann, for his part, called all these attacks un-Jewish. He would soon be out as chairman of the Zionist Executive, denied re-election at the Zionist Congress in Basel in December 1946. There were attacks on Jewish facilities and counterattacks on Jewish groups, political appeals to the Americans, especially Truman. Harry Truman vacillated for years, and he obsessed on one thing, gaining 100,000 immigration certificates for refugees to come to Israel. He vacillated on the issue of statehood. Bevin, Truman wants 100,000 more Jews in Israel because he doesn't want them in New York. So it provoked an intense debate in American political and diplomatic circles as to what should be done in Israel, whether the U.S. should get involved beyond making statements. The sentimentalists and the fair-minded favored statehood. The cold calculators opposed statehood for fear of offending the Arabs and losing access to their oil, as well as the fear that the Jews could not defend themselves from Arab attacks. Thus, there'd either be a massacre, horrific as it is, especially after the Holocaust, or the U.S. would have to send troops, which they did not want to do. And a third group simply detested Jews and did not want them to have independence. On November 29th, 1947, it was a Shabbat, Parshat Vayishlach, Tet Zayin Kislev, Tov Shin Chet, after the findings of yet another commission, UNSCOP, the UN voted 33-13, with I think 11 abstentions, to end the mandate and partition the land of Israel into a Jewish and Arab state, with the Jews receiving a sliver of land along the coast, some of the Galil, plus a good chunk of the Negev. Yerushalayim was to be an international city. The Arabs rejected it. The Zionists accepted it. The great film of the rejoicing and dancing in the streets of Yerushalayim, Tel Aviv, after the vote, is already after Shabbat here, still Shabbat in New York, where the vote took place. Zionists accepted, the Arabs rejected, and of course that old pattern would recur again and again. Both the U.S. and the Soviets voted in favor. This was a period of time, 1947, 1948, where the Soviet Union was pro-Zionist. It wasn't before, and it wasn't after. Yad Hashem. But now, Arab attacks on Jews began with a vengeance, and fears grew that independence could and would not happen. Behind the scenes, the Zionists pushed, including American Zionists, until Truman lost patience. After Eddie Jacobson's intervention, Truman met Weizmann, sneaked him into the White House, promising him that the U.S. would support statehood. The very next day, at the UN, the State Department countermanded Truman's policy and instead voted in favor of a trusteeship against statehood. Truman was flabbergasted and humiliated and realized that his own people were fighting against him, even as the Jews were pushing him from the other side. With the mandate expiring on May 14, 1948, the stakes were great. The British could not implement it, and they decided just to up and leave, helping more the Arabs prepare for the day after than the Jews. Truman was under tremendous pressure. George Marshall, former U.S. Chief of Staff of the Army, war hero, now Secretary of State, told Truman at one of the meetings in front of the cabinet, if the U.S. recognized Israel, Marshall would vote against Truman in the election of 1948, and he would so announce. But Truman decided to support statehood, and he never wavered. The Jews were less certain. The Zionist executive knew that war would come the moment the Brits left. Many voices claimed the Jews were unprepared. The Briska Rav said Pikuach Nefesh demanded that statehood not be declared. Even the cabinet was split. On Wednesday, May 12, 1948, Gimel Iyar, the provisional government met and voted 6-4 to approve the Declaration of Independence. It had all the hallmarks of every dispute up to this point for 100 years already. That 6-4 vote, the struggle over religion and state, the nature of the state, the relations with the Arabs, and especially what does it mean to have a Jewish state, all that was somehow encompassed and finessed in the Declaration of Independence, the Megillat Atzmaut, which really is almost a summary of all the disputes that raged for a century. It was all papered over, all to be fought another day, which is to say, every day since. At 4 p.m., Hey Iyar, Friday, May 14th, 1948, with the mandate expiring at midnight, the assembled at what is today now a museum on Sderot Rothschild in Tel Aviv sang HaTikva. David Ben-Gurion read the Declaration of Independence, and Rav Fishman Maimon recited Shechayonu. The very next act was to annul the white paper. For all his missteps, Ben-Gurion had midwifed an independent Jewish state into existence. He formed an army. He set up an economy that would eventually have to be superseded by one that worked, but nonetheless he did it. And he guided Israel through two wars. For all his personal flaws and his antipathy to Judaism, I don't mind at all that the airport is named for him. It was his great accomplishment, the Jewish state, albeit oblivious to the Yad Hashem that used him to carry it out. And so the Zionist dream was realized. It didn't stop Jew hatred, a persistent and perhaps the earliest objective. In fact, it now focused, coalesced hatred on the Jewish state and its inhabitants. It tried to create the new Jew, but didn't really succeed, as that Jew lost any real sense of his Jewishness. But what it did do is fulfill the dream of the prophets that we are now living. The prophetic vision as early as Moshe, who said, after a long period of exile and destruction and catastrophe, V'shav Hashem Elokecha Shvutcha V'richamecha. That God will restore your captivity, have mercy on you, gather from the nations. Even if you're scattered to the corners of the earth, God will gather you in. God will bring you back to the land that He bequeathed to your fathers, and you will conquer it and settle it, and you'll be even more successful, prosperous, more numerous there than your fathers were. If you ask, why does a Zionist establishment, the Jewish Agency, for example, still exist more than 70 years after achieving its goal, I would say, maybe shouldn't, but the answer is to keep alive and to impart the miracle of Israel's birth, the Chazon HaNeviim, the vision of the prophets, of Kibbutz Goliot, and the era of Atchalta de Geula. And that will hasten the day when all the sorrows of Tisha B'Av are behind us. It'll be a day of Sason V'Simcha, and we'll usher in the era of complete redemption in Biat Mashiach Tzidkenu B'mehera B'Yameinu. Amen. I thank again everyone for participating today and participating this year in our series. Tzom kal u'mo'il to everyone.